This is the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news. To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the mouth,
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
All right, so we're going to do something a little bit different this week. The NBA playoffs are underway, a little early to draw any conclusions as we record this podcast on Monday. So I want to bring in Dan Pfeiffer. Dan is the former White House Communications Director under Barack Obama, who has made the natural progression to full-time podcasting. He's the co-host of the incredibly popular podcast called Pod Save America. He's also an author. His new book is Yes, We Still Can, Politics in the Age of Obama, Twitter and Trump. It's out in June, but it's available for pre-order now. I just pre-ordered mine this weekend. And if you follow Dan on Twitter, you know he is a rabid Philadelphia 76ers fan, something I would imagine has not been easy to do in recent years. Dan, thanks for joining me, man.
Absolutely. This is super fun for me. And thank you for pre-ordering the book. I really appreciate that.
Hey, I'm looking forward to getting it sometime in during the NBA Finals in June. But Dan, like this is a strong basketball connection between the Obama administration and the NBA. I mean, presidents in general, most love sports, right? Bill Clinton had the Arkansas Razorbacks basketball team. George Bush actually owned the Texas Rangers. President Obama seemed to really like basketball, particularly NBA basketball. How would you describe, in your years there, his interest in the NBA?
I mean, super fan. Like, it is not an accident that one of the first things he did after leaving the White House was go speak at the Sloan Conference. Like, he was very deeply into the NBA and like in a real basketball fan, in the sense that, I mean, he's a Bulls fan. He roots for the Bulls. The Bulls were pretty good in our first couple years in the White House and the height of the pre-injury Derrick Rose years. But just basketball in general, like whenever we were flying home on Air Force One, usually you get in late at night, and like always on in the conference room in Air Force One where he would hang out was always whatever the TNT, TBS, ESPN, NBA game of the night is. Whether, you know, if the Bulls were on, great, but if it was, you know, Utah, Phoenix, he would watch that too. And so just like a true dyed-in-the-wool, deep NBA fan.
You know what I loved about his appearance at the Sloan Conference was the day before he got there, they announced it was all going to be off the record. Like, all the things that President Obama could have said in his lifetime, I would imagine talking to a bunch of basketball nerds wouldn't have needed to be off the record.
Yeah, I don't know what the backstory of that was. I can't imagine. One thing you know when you're president is almost nothing is ever actually truly off the record, particularly in a social media age. And so I don't know why that was, but he would always leap at the opportunity to talk basketball. There is this funny story from when, this is back in 2007, and we were campaigning in New Hampshire during the New Hampshire primary, and one of the political reporters for one of the papers in New Hampshire was interviewing him. And at the end of the interview, it was right after the 2007 NBA draft. And I think that must be right. Yeah, that's right. And he asked him what he thought about the Bulls pick. And that was the year that the Bulls picked Joakim Noah. And Obama, just forgetting that he was running for president, but and just being a basketball fan, then went on to analyze why the Bulls should not have picked Noah, because they'd already picked Tyrus Thomas the year before, and they had too many forwards who didn't have a solid jump shot. And not even thinking about it. And then the reporter, which was fully within his rights, wrote up a little blurb about that, which caused a huge to-do, because then there are all these stories in Chicago about how Obama craps on the pick. It turns out that Noah had been involved with Obama, with students for Obama at the University of Florida. And they have since become like friendly and got to know each other over the years. But it was just like, he was a basketball fan first and a presidential candidate second at that moment.
Yeah, because most politicians, it's, you know, well, both teams played hard. They're like Rasheed Wallace out there, like taking no position on anything when it comes to sports.
Yeah, that's right. This is also another New Hampshire story. So did he take his sports fandom very seriously? Which is, we were in Boston doing an event during the OA campaign, and it was the night that the Yankees and the Red Sox were going to play. And the person who organized the event gave Obama a Red Sox hat and said, "You should put it on and say you're rooting for the Red Sox tonight." Because people had, like, you know, this is like peak Red Sox Yankees rivalry. And Obama refused to do it. He said, because I'm a White Sox fan, and it would be totally phony to pretend to be a Red Sox fan for one night. So he went on stage and said, this guy who organized the event told me to put on a Red Sox hat, but I can't do that because I'm a White Sox fan. And the crowd went crazy because it seemed like genuine sports fandom, not like pander to whatever, be the fan of whatever town you're in.
Do you, Dan, as someone that's part of these campaigns, worry about, you know, potentially alienating crazy sports fans who are also voters in another market because of what your candidate might say?
No, I mean, some people do worry about that. I think it's kind of, I think voters, that gives voters too little credit that they can't separate, you know, whether they like, you know, like we did this, I mean, like when we were in North Carolina campaigning in 08, Obama played basketball with, practiced with the UNC Tar Heels. It was in the offseason. And people were like, this is crazy. Duke, you're going to anger all the Duke fans. And I was like, well, one, the Duke fans live in New Jersey, so that's not a huge problem. But two, but it's like people, I think people take their presidential politics seriously enough that if you're a Duke fan and you like Obama, you'll still vote for him, even if he played basketball with UNC. And he won by huge numbers in Illinois, even though he was a White Sox fan and many Cubs fans voted for him anyway. So if you're worrying about that, I think you're not giving the voters enough credit, and you're not thinking, you're overthinking something that should be much more fun and simple, like sports.
How often did he play, you know, generally during a week? Were pickup games a commonplace around the White House?
He, for the first few years, he probably played once every couple weeks, maybe, and more so in the winter when you couldn't golf. In the latter years, he kind of famously retired from pickup basketball. The way he would describe it is as he got older, the risk of catastrophic injury seemed higher, and the benefits of play, and he didn't feel like he could be as good as he used to be. And so the fun of playing went down, like in the risk benefit analysis of injury versus success went the other way. But he still always played, like we had a tradition that he always played on election day, and he played on the day of the Iowa caucus in 2008. So that was the first election day we faced as a presidential candidate, and he played. And there was a guy who was a state treasurer of Illinois named Alexi Giannoulis, who had played, I think, at Boston University and played professional ball in Greece for a while. And Alexi took it pretty seriously and cracked one of the president's ribs. And from that point on, I think we started to sort of decelerate the intensity of those games. But even then, I'm pretty sure, if I remember this correctly, and I guess in this era, it doesn't really matter anymore, but that he played with Scottie Pippen on election day 2012. And so he would get, you know, it'd be a fun game, but they try to get some fun people to play with. And then, I guess the first few years he played every couple weeks, and then sometimes several weeks in a row. And then in the later years, sort of on, you know, bigger occasions, like on his birthday, all of his friends he played basketball in high school would often come to town and they'd play, but he was less of a regular player in later years.
The guy that cracked his ribs, how'd his career path go?
I think he ran for Senate and lost, which is entirely unrelated to breaking Obama's ribs. They're still friends. They were friends. If I remember this correctly, they had played pickup ball in Chicago prior to Obama going to the White House. So I think they're still buddies.
You know, one of the election day game that you brought up before I left Sports Illustrated a couple of years ago, I had this story idea of I was going to try to get into that game, and I was going to write like this sort of stream of consciousness diary type thing where I'd sort of go go different routes, go to the press secretary, go to Reggie Love, go to different people and try to get into that game. It never kind of got off the ground, but you know, the players in that game, how did they get chosen? Who has the right to play in that game?
So the election day game was a little bit unique because they would sort of, it depended on where we were doing it. Were we in Chicago? Were we in DC? Were we in Iowa? If we were sort of on the road, it was mostly the traveling crew who were with the president, plus maybe some people who worked in that state. The regular pickup games were really interesting because the way they would do this is basically Reggie Love, who, as you mentioned, was president's body guy, played basketball at Duke, played football at Duke, very good basketball player, obviously. He would sort of recruit a bunch of guys that he played pickup ball with in D.C., and they were usually people in their 20s, maybe early 30s, who had played D1 ball somewhere, like an American or a guy who played at Boston University, another guy who played at Florida State. And then Arne Duncan, who was the Secretary of Education and played basketball at Harvard and played basketball overseas in Australia, and might be one of the all-time great pickup basketball players in American history. I mean, he is just the most, one of the most phenomenal. He is like a coach on the floor. I can tell stories about Arne all day long. Several time MVP of the NBA All-Star Celebrity Game. And Arne would organize sort of older basketball players closer to Arne in the president's age, which would be late 40s, early 50s, they had all played Division I basketball. But basically, Arne would always go find the absolute smartest basketball players he could find, people who just knew how to play the game. And usually the president's team and Arne's team would beat these younger, more athletic guys just by just having high IQ. You know, they're playing pickup, and Arne's out there like running backdoor cuts and like doing like a modified Princeton offense. And so that was sort of how they would do it. It's like it'd be the old guys versus the young guys. And the old guys would usually win, much to the chagrin of the younger guys.
Did, when Obama was playing, did he want opponents to play hard on him? Or was this, I mean, on the scale of 10 being, you know, go all out and one being, you know, Kim Jong Il having 18 consecutive hole in ones. Like, where was it?
I think it's probably closer to 8, and with the delta between 8 and 10 being don't injure him. Because like, you just imagine being president with a busted ACL or a ruptured Achilles, or even sort of more alarming was getting, you know, elbowed in the face, which did happen. He was playing over Thanksgiving back in 2010, and I was home. I was visiting my family for Thanksgiving, and like like 87 emails, the phones rang 12 times, and it was all because the president was playing basketball. This guy, he was a good guy who I also played in pickup with in DC separately, elbowed the president in the face accidentally, just sort of like in a clear out with the ball, and busted his nose and bled everywhere. And because he's the president, like the White House medical unit had to like swoop in. They had to take him to get like looked at, make sure nothing serious happened. And we had to release a statement to the press explaining what happened. It's like, so he wanted you to play hard and treat him like he was anyone else. But don't punch him in the face, basically.
I just had like a deja vu of the opening scene of West Wing of the first episode, yeah. POTUS in a bicycle accident.
It's very similar to that, actually. That was our deja vu feeling when that happened. Was we had to, that is the Obama version of that scene. It's not a bike accident, but an errant elbow in a basketball game.
I know I used to see clips of, and a lot of the time it was the Bulls players, it was Derrick Rose or Noah that were around the White House. Did Obama recruit guys to come, not recruit, that might be the wrong word, but, you know, invite guys to come play there when they were in town? Did he invite other players from other teams when they were in town?
He would, a lot of times players, when they would come play the Wizards, would, like the teams would want to get a White House tour and go sort of get a behind the scenes look. And we would often organize that. And Obama knew a lot of these guys. He had met them. You know, if they had played in Chicago, he probably knew them. If he had played, I mean, I remember early in the campaign, we arrived in LA late at night and we were like really late flight. We were coming, getting in our hotel, and it was just as a, I think it must have been the Suns at the time. Yeah, it must have been the Suns. We're going out, and like Jalen Rose comes up and talks to Obama. It was like Jalen Rose and Sean Marion, and he had known Jalen Rose from when Jalen had been on the Bulls, I believe. And so these guys would come in, and a lot of them campaigned for us in 2008. And if Obama was free, he'd say hi. He would also, Reggie would also do this, is recruit players to play with Obama in the offseason. Like in, I guess this must have been what, early in his career, Durant came and played. I think it was after his rookie year. For Obama's 50th birthday party, they basically put together a pickup game that had every NBA player you could think of playing. So it was LeBron, Wade, Chris Paul, Derrick Rose, Joakim Noah, Grant Hill, and then like retired players like Alonzo Mourning and Magic played in the game. And so like that was his birthday present that people had organized for him, was this ability to play with NBA players for one day, which I got to go to that game and watch it, which was an amazing thing to see.
I was going to say, even for the president, that's got to be pretty cool, like to have those guys in one place.
He loved it. And it was super fascinating to watch because everyone was playing, like Maya Moore played in the game, and it was a combination of the president's friends he played basketball with in high school and sort of some of his pickup buddies these NBA players, Reggie Love played in the game, and they would sort of mix up the teams, like half NBA players. It'd be like two or three NBA players, two non-NBA players. And it was totally fascinating to watch because it was everyone was going super easy. And then as we get close to game point, the NBA players would start getting very serious about it, particularly Chris Paul. At one point, Reggie like gets a steal and is going down for the break. And because Shane Battier was in the game, and Shane Battier had been, I think, a senior when Reggie was a freshman at Duke, and they were on that same national championship team together, like all of a sudden, Shane Battier, like something clicks in his mind, and he sees Reggie going in for what should be an uncontested dunk, and he just sprints from half court as fast as he can and pins Reggie's shot against the backboard, and then like talks crap to him like after it's over, just like settling some score from Duke basketball from like a decade prior. But it was a fascinating thing to see, and the president loved it. It was really cool. Like Kobe Bryant came because he came to the birthday party, but he was injured at the time. Bill Russell was there. And so like Kobe and Bill Russell sat next to each other and talked for like hours. I mean, just the whole thing was a huge thrill for him, and actually pretty cool for all of us who got to watch it too.
I thought you were going to say Shane Battier took a charge. That would have been even better. Like
he probably did actually at some point. The other thing that was cool about that was they invited all these kids who had been in this mentoring program and a bunch of wounded warriors from some of the nearby military bases. Then after the game, all the players stayed and signed every autograph and gave every piece of clothing they had to the kids. They all left like with no shoes. Like they gave their shoes to everyone. The whole thing was awesome. And all the players could not have been less diva or prima donna about it. They were just there to play basketball, have fun. They thought it was cool to be near the president and help these kids. And it was like a real way to see these guys not on TV or in a game, but just being like sort of real people.
That's awesome. Yeah. The other thing Obama was good at when it came to sports was, the White House visits, and I didn't watch all of them, but I did watch all the NBA ones, and it seemed like he really enjoyed those visits, and even his speeches were fantastic. My favorite one was the Heat when Mario Chalmers was there, and he turned around and said, you know, it's not always Mario's fault, which is like the ultimate NBA inside joke that everybody yells at Mario Chalmers. I've watched that a dozen times, Dan. It was, I don't know who wrote that, but it was terrific.
I think that, if I remember this correctly, I think that was actually an Obama ad lib, because like he's deep in this. He's watching SportsCenter. If he gets a chance, he's watching PTI. He's watching these games, so he knows what's particularly for the NBA ones. He knows what sort of the cultural elements of the conversation that real sports fans are having. You know, and it's like you do so many hard, challenging, pressure-filled, stressful things as president that these will always be sort of fun things on the schedule, right? And where, you know, he get to see some guys he might be friends with or might know, and we always would invite like fans of that team, whether they're like former White House staff or members of Congress or just people we knew and who would be there. And it's like always incredibly, it's just like a real beacon of mostly unserious fun. In the later years, particularly with the NBA teams, because the NBA has such a really good community service oriented part of its organization, we would organize, I didn't help organize these, but particularly the First Lady's office and the visitor's office of the White House would put together service projects and other things. Or if the players were in town, they'd ask them if they'd be willing to go speak at a school in DC or something. And so they'd build more than just show up, give the speech, take a ring, but try to make a day of it and leverage the opportunity to have these kids around, have these players around to do something in the mentoring space or to sort of help with community service and draw attention to important issues.
You know, Obama exited office at such a relatively young age, and we know he's got a lot, going on right now with his various causes and things he's working on. But do you think as a sports fan, he'd ever consider an offer to be a commissioner of a sports league?
I don't know if he'd be commissioner, but I think if he had an opportunity to be part of an ownership group for a team, he would be, for an NBA team, he'd be very interested in that. I think that's sort of almost any sports fan stream. I mean, A, you're wealthy enough to be part of an ownership team, so that's awesome. And two, you could get to like you get to like be involved in some sort of constructive way on a day-to-day basis in a sport you love. I don't think there's nothing in the immediate offing that I'm aware of, and I'd be surprised if it's any time in the very near future, but at some point later in his life, I would not be shocked to see President Obama having some involvement in the ownership of an NBA team in some way, shape, or form.
I'd love to be in an owner's meeting with Michael Jordan and Obama, like sitting across from each other negotiating something in the collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah, that's a lot of alpha dogs in one room.
Seriously. So for people that follow Dan on Twitter, it's like political tweet, political tweet, political tweet, and something generally angry about the 76ers. Am I getting that right, Dan?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say angry this year. This year has been a very celebratory experience for a Sixers fan. But yeah, it's like a lot of Sixers, particularly this year, because the Sixers have been so interesting all year long. In previous years, a lot of Georgetown basketball. I went to Georgetown. I was a season ticket holder for many years and lived in D.C. They've been in a transition year for the last few years, so it's been a slightly less interesting. They've been less in the forefront, and then just general NBA basketball, because I live out here in San Francisco in Warriors country now, so I see the Warriors on TV all the time. But a lot of people, I said in my Twitter bio, I have, you know, co-host about Save America, worked in the White House, blah, 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 blah. And then at the end, I just put process truster, which is very confusing to a lot of non-basketball people. Like, unless you're pretty deep into NBA Twitter, you don't really understand what that means. And so a lot of people sometimes tweet at me if I, like, have questions about, the nature of some investigation or not. It's like, but you said in your bio you trust the process. Like, no, you don't get it. It's a different process that I trust.
So you were born in Delaware. Is that Sixers country?
Yeah, that is. So I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, which is probably, when I was a kid, 25 minutes from the Spectrum where the Sixers played back in the 80s. And one of my first sports memory was my dad. I must have been like 7 or 8. My dad taking me to see the Dr. J Sixers, sort of at the tail end of the Dr. J era. And Sixers fan all the way through. You know, obviously the Barkley years were great. And then because I was at Georgetown at the exact same time, Allen Iverson and I were in the same freshman class at Georgetown. Then to have Iverson go to the Sixers and then do that run, and particularly through the 01 finals appearance, was like, I've been sort of a rabid Sixers fan for years. And the challenge until recently is, like, what do you do when your team is out of it by Thanksgiving? Like, how do you like quench your basketball fandom? And so for years I've been picking sort of, it's like Sixers first. And then now that the Sixers are out of it, like, who do I want to see win? Who am I going to root for on a day-to-day basis when they're playing everyone other than the Sixers? And for a while that was the Thunder with Durant, because Durant was a DC player, and having lived in DC for many years, I root for DC guys. And then I adopted the Warriors as my Sixers alternate team for years. And then which became more complicated this year when the Sixers are now, you know, with like whatever it is, 7-1 favorites to make it to the finals or something absurd where they could potentially play the Warriors. But Sixers fan through and through, went through the dark years, had kept hope, faith in Sam Hinkie all the way, and really enjoyed this year a lot.
You and Iverson in the same poli sci classes, I assume.
I will tell you, the Iverson had to go. Georgetown does not mess around for those first 2 years. Because every student has to have to do the same. Like, you don't pick your major until your junior year. And so every student, whether they are a potential number one NBA draft pick or just some schlub from Delaware, have to go take the same, English 101, intro to philosophy, intro science classes. And so I didn't have classes with Iverson, but I had many friends who did, and he was there. And this is the old, you know, John Thompson era, and those guys went to class. There was, if you didn't go to class, you had to answer to Big John, and no one wanted to do that. So, like, my friends who had classes with Iverson said he was there every day on time, as were all the other basketball players, because if you weren't, John Thompson heard about it, and he does something to say, you would probably be running sprints until you threw up at practice. So it was a different era in college sports in some ways, because, you know, Iverson was the first Georgetown player to leave early. So all these guys were sort of on a 4-year bill with Thompson. So they took it seriously, and the school made him take it seriously.
I would have loved to have been in a philosophy class with Iverson just to sit through that and see how he would react in a class like that.
I mean, he is, I always found Iverson to be one of the most interesting public figures in basketball, because he obviously has this rebellious instinct. He's had troubles. He's also one of the most competitive human beings to ever walk the face of the planet. He's clearly very bright in a lot of ways. And when you listen to him talk, he's a very, particularly like when he was like in the sort of that MVP season, just a real self-awareness for him about himself, about his flaws, about the sort of the cultural role that he sort of played by being unwilling to make concessions to the way the world thought, you know, an African-American NBA player should act and look, and sort of just being himself. I think he's a super interesting guy. It would have been fascinating to have in a philosophy or an ethics class for sure.
Yeah, he's a fascinating figure and someone that's as articulate as any guy that I've ever talked to in my career. He has deep answers to questions. And yeah, you're right about that. The process, though, you trust it now. Did you trust it 5 years ago?
Yes, the only time I doubted the process was on the Okafor pick. I was so angry. It was both like I was very wrong. Like I don't have a great history of deciding who would be great NBA players, but I was incredibly confident about Embiid. And I did tweet from my White House account, which was probably deeply inappropriate after watching Kansas and Georgetown play in that Wiggins Embiid season, that Embiid should be the number one pick in the draft. It's not even a close call. And then obviously the Sixers only got him because of the injuries. And then at the Okafor year, I was so mad that we drafted Okafor. Now I thought we should have drafted Emmanuel Mudiay, so I shouldn't be an NBA draft an NBA general manager anytime soon. But
if you had said Porzingis, I would have been impressed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd like to wish I could go back into history to do that, but I think there are tweets that suggest I would not have that I would have been wrong on that. But I bought the system. I believed in it. It made sense to me. And part of it's like you're a fan, you're grasping for something. And where I really thought the process worked, and I thought the Sixers did this really right, was Brett Brown, which is you bring in a coach. You bring in a coach with a real pedigree who has a history, who comes from a system that works, and then you give him a long leash to get through those years. The process would have been a disaster if it was like, we're processing, we're tanking, and then it's like, oh, we had a bad season, we're going to ditch a coach and start all over again. It's like, it was the long-term vision of the process is what I think a lot of Sixers fans appreciated. Because I think, you know, it's like the Knicks. One week they're tanking, the next week they're signing Derrick Rose. It's like you don't never know. Like no one can commit to a system because there's this short-termism from a general manager who thinks they might get fired or a coach who thinks they might get fired, so they don't play the young players. And everyone has moments of doubt. I certainly did around Okafor, but the end result here is something that's pretty impressive to watch, both obviously the talent they got. And look, they missed a bunch of picks in there too. Okafor was a bad pick. Noel was a bad pick. Fultz, I think, looks really good recently, but we can discuss that. They got lucky. They got Embiid later than they should. And Simmons was a consensus number one. No one was not picking Simmons that year, even though I guess some people thought Ingram was a better player, which is an insane idea to me. But it's also the culture. Like that team, they play hard. They love each other. They love Brett Brown. There's something that is very impressive about how they had a vision and they executed it, and it worked great. You know, and the Saric pick too. The Saric pick was really like to have seen the value in Saric over Elfrid Payton in that trade was a really impressive piece of hinky wizardry.
No, and it whether it's Šarić or Elfrid Payton, who's now out there in the Phoenix wilderness, which is not good for him. I mean, it's a no-brainer there. And Hinkie, I'm almost surprised. Actually, I am very surprised that he hasn't landed another job at this point. I mean, I've talked to Sam about this. You know, he wouldn't do things the exact same as he did it in Philly. I think in Philly he was way too standoffish with the media. He was just way too hands-off, I think, with his own team, with the players there. He was a little too cold, a little too calculating, and he didn't recognize that you can lose without being biblically bad every single year. You could bring in an Ish Smith at the end of one season and still lose, but not do it in an embarrassing way. I think Sam would do those things differently, and if you add that to what he already is, I think he'd make a great GM somewhere else.
Yeah, I think the Sam is defined by tanking for draft picks, but people don't realize that he made great trades. I mean, the Michael Carter Williams trade is one of the all-time great NBA heists. He had an asset. He saw that it was one of those years where the rookie of the year is not that he was peaking. He sold high on an asset that's going to end up being a lottery pick years down the road. It's just like in the Šarić thing, like all along the line, he made really smart trades. I think a team would be, I'd hate to see him on another team because that would alarm me as a Sixers fan, but he has more than earned the right. You know, I just don't know. The NBA, we're not huge fans of Sam, so I don't know whether, I don't know, I'm not saying he's blackballed, but that it's a controversial hire, but he should have another team. He thinks he understands the modern NBA. He looks for the inefficiencies in the system and looks to exploit them. And like what was so impressive about him is I think in the NBA, but in all sports, there's groupthink. Everyone sort of starts doing the exact same thing at the same time. And you know, like we have every team's the mini Warriors now, right? But who's looking for the next thing? So what's your differentiation? And Sam had thought differently about basketball, and it has borne great, has potential at least to have borne great fruit for the Sixers, given what their future looks like right now.
Support for this podcast, as always, comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Mannix, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. You know, one of the things, Dan, that you and I have tweeted back and forth that over the last year has been Markelle Fultz and specifically his injury. And in addition to, why he's hurt and what he's going through, how the Sixers handled that injury publicly, which was, I guess, bizarre is probably the best way to put it in terms of how they put out information about this injury. As a fan of the team, what did you think about the injury and how the Sixers handled it?
Well, I was very, as my tweets would reveal, I was very concerned about it. Seemed like Fultz's agent was saying one thing, and they're like telling Woj about some sort of injury, and then they're saying that's not what the injury was, and the team has a different view, and whether it was Brian Colangelo or whoever else would sort of like their public remarks, just from a pure PR strategy, were sowing confusion about what the actual truth was. And it was problematic. What I think they deserve a lot of credit for, I think the external stuff was bumpy at the beginning, but in the end, and I think Brett and the team deserve incredible credit for this, is like here is a kid who is going through a something, right? And becoming a net potential, he became the punchline of a joke on NBA Twitter, and people were very aggressive about him, and like every little video of him that came out of him shooting, everyone would make fun of, and they built a cocoon around him and stuck with him and kept his confidence up to the point where they could bring him back and he could be a contributing role player on a 50-win team in the final stretches heading into the playoffs. And so internally, even if the external stuff was bumpy, the internal stuff was clearly impressive. And, you know, I obviously follow all these guys on social media, and it's like wherever they're on the road, you see like Embiid and Markel Fultz like visiting the beach in L.A. or doing all these things. And it could have been very easy for the team to get mad at him and dismissive of him and sort of make him an outcast. And then you never bounce back from this. But they, and I think this is the culture that Brett Brown built, is that they, like, just the reaction the team had when he had his triple double in the Milwaukee game was just like, just so joyful and inspiring. And the Philly fans too, like Philly fans are, they have a bad rep, and maybe it's the, having the burden of losing, of winning a Super Bowl over their head, like off of them, that they just have been so supportive of Fultz. Because, you know, the Philly fans from when I was growing up would have turned on Fultz in 2 seconds. And like on WIP radio, they would have been trashing him and everyone would have been saying stuff. But although I guess I would say this in defense, is that the Philly fans also defended Iverson when everyone else was coming after Iverson in a similar way. Like they, like, I think maybe they're tough on you unless everyone else is tough on you, then they sort of wrap you, then they protect you. So, you know, I feel my critiques in the beginning were, I think, have been proven. I think from a PR strategy, they made mistakes, but from the actual process of getting him ready to play and making sure they get value from that pick, the early signs are really good.
There's that word again, process.
That's right.
Always keeps right rearing its head with the 76ers.
Yeah. I would say this, that if you could do that draft over again, I would make that pick again. Even knowing what you know about.
You'd take.
Well, I mean, I guess maybe you take Mitchell. But other than that, like, I remember sitting, I was super excited for that draft, for that move, because I was looking at that draft and I'm thinking, Tatum looks pretty good, but he's kind of playing in the same place that Saric is. Lonzo seems, could be a great player, but there's a LeVar issue, but also he doesn't fit with Simmons if Simmons is going to run the point, and he doesn't shoot well. He can't play off ball. Josh Jackson, not sure what role he plays on the Sixers. Fultz was the only one who made sense. So it was the right move to make. And there's, you see some of the, like, we'll see how this plays out. If he ever gets his jump shot fully back, I think he's got real ability, but, you know, and he's playing against second team, so like temper the enthusiasm, but you can just see some of the, like, the guy's a shot maker, and you every once in a while you just see like you see why he was a consensus number one pick. And so I continue to trust the process when it comes to Markel Fultz.
I tell you what though, I would probably have taken Tatum given what we've seen from Tatum, because now that we know that Ben Simmons is a one, and he's probably going to be a one for most of his career, I think that you put a scorer like Tatum alongside Simmons at the three, you're just dangerous. You're real dangerous offensively. Plus, you have to throw in the fact that the Sixers gave up, you know, what's probably going to be the Sacramento Kings pick next year inside that top 10. That makes it a little more tough. But I'm with you, though, on Fultz. I think Fultz is going to be a good player. I think that, you know, he's being compared to Tatum, to Mitchell, to all these other guys right now. But if he does get that jump shot back, and I think it could become serviceable. I mean, hell, he was a 41% three-point shooter in college. If he gets that back, he's going to be a frontline starter in this league for a long time.
People forget with Fultz, like Mitchell is incredible and totally unique. But people, like, Tatum has been destined for the NBA forever. Like, people forget with Fultz that 4 years ago, he was on the JV team at DeMatha. And he just had, he came out of nowhere. And so he went on this 3-year run of becoming a starter at DeMatha, becoming an all Met player there, becoming somehow the, you know, a top three recruit, going to Washington and then becoming the consensus number one pick from almost the time he stepped on campus. And like that sort of run, he is and having played at Washington in this sort of bizarre losing situation, he was less tested in sort of under the Klieg lights of big time basketball than some of these guys like Tatum who have been or Josh Jackson who have been known to be, you know, have been on the ESPN, you know, top 25, top 60, 100 since the day they walked into high school. And so I think there's real potential there. You know, the Tatum Mitchell Fultz debate is a, like, you can go any way you want. I think Tatum is way better than I thought he was going to be. And, you know, we'll see in that 2019 draft where that Kings pick is and what, you know, and if it ends up being someone phenomenal, then we'll probably, then I'll probably, I could revisit my view of it. But we're also running out of places to put young prospects on the Sixers.
And you're running out of the money that might be needed to pay him too. And that I think is a question that's going to come up in the next couple of years. I've noticed, you know, Josh Harris is making his victory laps the last couple of days with the way the Sixers have played. But I don't know. Do you have confidence that that ownership group, which just paid Joel Embiid $150 million, will give Ben Simmons $150 million, will give Dario Saric whatever he's worth, will give Fultz whatever he's worth? I mean, if they want to keep that team together, Dan, that's a massive luxury tax bill they're going to have to pay.
I'm nervous about this. You know, there's no better example of the danger of this than the Wizards, who were sitting on those Beal, Gortat, wall contracts, plus
completely landlocked.
Especially the abominable Mahinmi contract. Then you sign Porter, and they have no bench, and they have no capacity to solve that problem unless they trade Wall or Beal, which seems not ideal. So that is the big concern. How do you? You know, the window for the Sixers may actually be while Simmons is still on his rookie contract, frankly. And because you end up being in this situation where you have Embiid at a max contract, Saric at a near max contract, Simmons at a max contract, Fultz, you know, you got another 3 years on the rookie deal after this, but it's, it gets very, I mean, then you're just scraping the bottom of the barrel, and all of a sudden you're playing like Jason Terry. You look a little bit like the Bucks, right? You're playing Jason Terry and Brandon Jennings off the bench at the end of games. And like unless you're the Warriors or the Spurs, you're not getting really quality NBA players on a minimum contract. So yeah, it's very concerning, the window. And I think this is one of the things you're seeing in sports all across the board, is your best bet is when you get a really good player on a phenomenal deal. The Warriors don't become the Warriors if Curry does not sign that deal off a bunch of bad ankles, and they can afford to keep Draymond, keep Clay, and have a bench like that. This is why I have great skepticism about the idea of LeBron as a Sixer in the short term, in the near term. The Sixers have young length and prospects, and you don't want to have to trade that for a bunch of old, you know, Mike Miller redux.
Yeah, and you know, the problem, well, not a problem, but you know, Philadelphia's biggest issue moving forward is hitting on all those picks that Hanky left them with, the late first round picks that they're going to have that are their own, the second round picks that are in the bank. One of the reasons that I think, I mean, that, you know, San Antonio is, they're the Spurs, because not just because of Duncan, but because Ginobili, Parker, these guys were late first round, second round picks. You know, you mentioned Golden State, they hit on these second round picks, whether it's McCaw or Jordan Bell. These guys become rotation players. Brian Colangelo has to nail all these. He has to hit every one of his value picks to make sure this team's roster is fleshed out with cheap talent for the future.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That it is the teams that are great get value out of the late round picks. You know, and even, I mean, the Spurs are the best example of, you know, whether it's DeJounte Murray or Kyle Anderson or these players who, where you are, and this is why, you know, this is like this interesting, I listen to all the NBA, I'm like a NBA draft nerd, and like there is a real interesting debate about, are you swinging for the fences to try to find Giannis in the late first round, right? Or are you drafting a good college player who can give you value for some number of years on a rookie deal, right? And that's what the Spurs have been very good at, right? And that's the Warriors picking Jordan Bell, I think the Sixers are going to have to be really smart about it. It is like the next stage of the process is trying to find players who can contribute late in those right away, not someone who's a 6-year project, because they're going to spend 2 years playing and, you know, for Barcelona or whatever else, people who will come be able to get in right away and add value off the bench. And that's almost harder than I think swinging for the fences with some of these first round picks. Cause that's a lot of smarts, but also a lot of luck. The other one is being really smart about how to get value from those picks.
I feel like you just went from optimistic to pessimistic in the span of about 15 minutes.
That is, I mean, that's also my, anyone who follows me on politics, I do the same thing too. Like, I feel great. And then the world's falling out. Look, I think as long as you have Ben Simmons, who, I mean, Embiid is amazing. I love Embiid. Simmons, but there's always the injury risk with Embiid. Like, how are you going to get 60 plus games out of him every year for how many years? And I think the Sixers were right to give that contract. I don't think there was another option. And you just got to, this is the bet you made and you got to double down on it. But Simmons is amazing. He is so poised, so good, so just like, I mean, he is something like we haven't seen in a very long time in the NBA. And I think the future is so bright for him. You know, hopefully one day he has a jump shot, but I'm not sure he needs one in the short term. And so you have those pieces. Like, you, I mean, the Sixers currently, they have two, I would argue, certainly two top 20 and maybe two top 15 NBA players on their team right now. And both of those players are under the age of 25. So it seems very, so from that front, I'm very perspective. But obviously, you need to have some view of the challenges of maintain, you know, it's building sustainable success in the NBA and not making mistakes. And I think the Colangelo, I think the full trade was the right thing to do at the time. You know, we'll see if it plays out. But we don't know yet what the post Hinkie management is going to be like in terms of talent evaluation and drafting. And so that is a question.
Yeah, I think you, in the very near future, probably going to have two top five NBA players in Simmons and Embiid. They're just tracking on that level. All right, let me ask you about NBA players in particular are very outspoken on social issues. I mean, LeBron leads the charge on this, but, you know, all down the line, from Dwayne Wade to Carmelo to some of the younger players, they're unafraid to speak out on these mainstream issues. And the NBA, to its credit, gives them a lot of rope to do that, whether it's wearing you know, different types of t-shirts and jerseys during warmups to advocate for a cause or to bring attention to something. In general, Dan, what kind of impact do socially active athletes have on the business of Washington?
I think it is, I don't know how much it has an impact on the actual business of Washington in the sense, like, I don't know that LeBron speaking out about Trump is convincing a lot of people who were pro-Trump to not be for Trump. Although there is some of it, there is some element of it. Like, I have a friend from Washington who is from Texas, who has family who lives outside of San Antonio, and they are pretty conservative. You know, I don't know that they're like the most rabid pro-Trump people, but they're Republicans for sure, and they voted for Trump. And Popovich's words about Trump affect them. I don't know that they're going to change their mind and vote for a Democrat next time, but the fact, like, Popovich is someone that they have obviously loved and respected for 20 years, and all of a sudden to hear his, like, it makes them at least think in their head, huh, Popovich is as smart a guy as I know. He's an interesting guy. I respect him. If he has this opinion, maybe I should think about it. And so in that sense, there, you know, some people, and I think Popovich and Kerr fall into this category. I think for the place where athletes can have the most value is two things. One, using their social presence, their fame to bring attention to issues that are not otherwise being talked about. I think what LeBron and Wade and others did, I think it was at the ESPYs about Trayvon Martin, was, you know, incredibly powerful. And you have you know, these athletes who do not ascribe to the old Jordanism about Republicans buying sneakers too, and are just willing to get out there, and it gets attention, right? And so people talk about it. And so I think that's the most powerful part of what they do. You know, I'm biased here, but seeing Ben Simmons I guess the two things. One, they bring awareness. The other thing is they can encourage people who are fighting on these issues. Like, I think Ben Simmons wearing the March for Our Lives t-shirt to warm up at the Sixers game on the day of the march probably meant a lot to Sixers fans. Oh, here's someone who didn't have to, who's supporting us. And I think that's encouraging. But I don't think athletes and coaches are going to win the election for the Democrats or win it for the Republicans, but they have the fact that they're using their voice certainly helps for sure.
Do you ever wonder, I mean, Donald Trump goes after everybody that criticizes him. Greg Popovich napalms him, like, in pregame press conferences almost weekly. Yeah, and yet you never hear Trump say a word about Popovich, who is as I mean, he's probably one of the biggest, you know, coaching figures, if not the biggest coaching figure in the NBA, one of the most famous people in the NBA. You ever wonder why he doesn't, you know, respond to Popovich's really strong words?
I mean, certainly when given a like just the record, let the like I can't say I can see into Trump's mind, and I hope I never can. But he clearly sees opportunity in going after African American athletes as opposed to white coaches. Like he could have gone, like Steve Kerr has been his who is one of my favorite people in the NBA. He was a Pod Save America guest. He's worn his pod merch to practice, which we love every time. And he's been as aggressive going after Trump as anyone, you know, certainly as near as aggressive as Popovich. And who on the Warriors did Trump come after? Steph Curry. So I don't think it, you know, once may be a coincidence, 800 times is a pattern. So I think he, like, sowing division along racial lines has been a big part of Trump's strategy for a long time. And so he probably doesn't see a lot of upside in going after Popovich, but going after LeBron, going after Steph Curry, obviously going after Colin Kaepernick, is in line with how he usually operates. And so that's the sort of thing, like, you're not going to launch 1,000 Fox News segments about going after Popovich, which you will going after Curry or Kaepernick or LeBron.
So the book's out next month, or June rather, June 19th is the release date of the book. I've wondered, as someone that listens to your podcast weekly, what do you save for the book that's not in the podcast?
Oh, so much. But buy the book and you'll find out. So a couple things about the book. It comes out June 19th. It is the concept of the book is the idea that I woke up the day after the election, and waking up's a little bit of a stretch because I slept like 45 minutes that night, and just wondered what happened. How did we get here? And I don't pretend to have the answer to that question. I think that is a sociological, historical, political question. But what I did notice as I thought back on the Obama years is that all of the sort of the forces that help bring us to this moment where Donald Trump could be president, changes in the media, the emergence of conspiracy theories and fake news, the emergence of a large Republican media operation centered around Fox News, sort of the Republican Party moving very far to the right, were all things that existed before Trump. And they were things that Obama battled every day from the day he started running for president in 2007 to the day he left in January 2017. And so I wanted to take a look at all of those things and help explain to people, tell the story of how Obama navigated those very specific forces and offer some ideas and thoughts for how Democrats and progressives, what lessons Democrats and progressives could learn from that. And so it, you know, if you like Pod Save America, or you like the Thursday edition of Pod Save America, or one half of the Thursday edition of Pod Save America, this this book will, I think, be something you like. And it's got, you know, it's got some never before told stories about how Obama dealt with these things. I also threw in some funny stories about some other things that were just sitting back there. So I like to think of it as a Pod Save America-esque take on the changes in our politics and where we go from there. And hopefully, I've never written a book before. Most of my communications these days are south of 280 characters. I think people will find it to be funny, hopefully interesting, and reminder of that it was not that long ago that we were in a different time in America with a different president who had a different approach. And if you missed that time, this might be the book for you.
Could you have ever imagined kind of doing what you're doing now? Like, you know, I'm assuming you had a different idea of what your life would be like, you know, post White House work.
You know, it's funny you say that. If Donald Trump had lost, I would not have written this book, and we would most likely not have a podcast. Even though we had done a podcast before the election, it was sort of called Keeping It 1600 on Bill Simmons' Ringer Network. Our thought was once Hillary won, we do it for a few months and then shut it down. And I would trade the book and the podcast for a different election result. But unfortunately, time travel's not been invented, so here we are. But it did. When I was leaving the White House, people did ask me, like, whose life, you know, would you want? Like, what would be a really, like, if you could look at just professionally, what would be like a really interesting sort of perspective? And some people I work with be like, I want to be Tim Russert, or I want to be David Remnick and run the New Yorker, or, you know, be a whatever. My answer was Bill Simmons. Was if you could have a podcast, sort of write about sports, talk about pop culture some, that would be a super interesting life. Now, this is a sort of the bizarro version of that, and I certainly don't get to do my friends at Crooked Media have not yet granted my many requests to do an NBA trade value column, but I've been fascinated by the value of podcast as a communications medium since I started listening to it back in 2009, just because it's one of those rare things in media where you can have a longer conversation and not try to condense anything into 30-second sound bites or 280-character tweets. And so I'm pretty excited that we get to do it. It's not – certainly if you'd asked me 20 years ago, would my life be like this? Absolutely not. Maybe you've even asked me 10 years ago. But it's pretty great to be able to have – given – like I said, would trade everything for a different political environment where I could just – where I would have a different, more normal life. But given the context, having the opportunity to talk about politics and with some of my very good friends on a weekly basis is a pretty fun way to try to survive the Trump years.
I mean, the alliteration value alone of Pod Save the Process is I know.
Right? It's not really it's a very narrow segment of people who I think would subscribe. And I am a huge and devoted fan of the ultimate process podcast, The Rights of Ricky Sanchez. Spike Eskin and Mike are phenomenal, and so they really they own the process corner. But like if there was ever a world where I had a sports podcast, I mean, maybe no one listened to it. Basically, I would just like talking on a microphone about NBA basketball and draft prospects and all of that. That would be a great way to spend 45 minutes of my life. But as it relates to Sixers podcasts, we already have a champ on that corner.
Well, Dan, the podcast you're doing now is great. The book comes out June 19th. I'm sure I'll see you in Oakland when the Sixers play the Warriors in June. But thanks for joining, man. I really appreciate this. It was fun.
Absolutely. I had a blast, and a Sixers Warriors. My wife is pregnant. We have a baby coming in May. And if the Sixers make the finals, the only way I will get to see them is if they play the Warriors. So I'm not getting on a plane to go to Houston or Philly with a 3-week-old if that happens, but I might be able to get on the BART and head out to Oakland for that game. So yeah, I'm definitely rooting for that outcome.
You got to get a hall pass for the Sixers. I mean, that goes without saying, I think.
I trust the process so much that this is the beginning of a long run of finals appearances. So baby can come first this time.
Hey, Dan, enjoyed it, man. Thanks for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Chris.
That's it for this week's episode. And to my listeners, I apologize for this raspy voice that I'm dealing with. I play in the Northeast weather. But to listen to archived episodes, check us out on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.